Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. So who is the son of the preacher man? Is that me or you, Rabbi?
My father was in retail, so I don't know if that qualifies as a preacher man, but he worked 7 days a week, and then when he retired, he went to his services every day. So I guess
that's our introduction. I guess that must be me.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning. Reb, I have to tell you, you and I have been together for many, many years, and I have experienced, as you have, one of the most difficult, debilitating weeks, given the news that came out of Memphis, given the news that came out of Jerusalem. But I said to people just last night, we all see the ugliness in America. Let's not lose sight of the beauty of America. When you surround yourself with very decent, dedicated people, you recognize that there's hope for the future. One of those people is joining us now, and that's the former chief of the Department of NYPD, Kenneth Corey. I've known him, you've known him, for some time, and he's one of the best. He's the gold standard when it comes to policing. Ken Corey, welcome to the Reverend Rabbi.
Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning, Reverend. How are you guys doing this morning?
We're doing well. Welcome to the program. So Rabbi, where do we want to start with
this? Look, how does one explain the inexplicable, Chief Corey? You look at that video, you're sickened by it. It's shameful. There are no words, but we turn to you for some kind of understanding of what went wrong here. What happened?
Well, listen, I mean, that video is extremely difficult to watch. I mean, 34 years in policing, and then that's one of the most horrific things I've seen. I mean, imagine the level of violence that I experienced in 34 years that I witnessed, and that's right up there at the top of it. I mean, the entire situation, when I look at that video, and I've watched it multiple times, you know, it's completely unnecessary, the force that's being used. It's unjustifiable. It's inexcusable, and quite frankly, it's inhumane. The way that those five men are beating Tyree Nichols.
You know, I don't even think they're police. I think they're wearing the uniforms, but as you say, they're certainly not behaving like police. What inspires people to act this way, Chief?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you'd really have to see what their history is and, you know, how they come to be in that department. You know, recruiting, you know, police recruiting across the country right now is suffering and has been suffering for a number of years. Many, many departments, including the NYPD, are well below what their authorized staffing is. And so there is a great temptation out there, and more than a temptation in many places, to lower hiring standards, to lower training standards, to just get bodies in the door. And that's a short-term fix, maybe, that always leads to a greater problem down the road.
You know, how do you respond, Chief? I think that as a nation, we showed great restraint. I mean, the national and community, local response was quite calm. I mean, you know, an upset about the abuse of power by those that we put in positions of trust. But at the same time, it was not the kind of outbreak of violence. And I'm not talking about organizations who seek to exploit these opportunities, but I'm talking about the community at large. What's your response to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you completely, Reverend. And you know, when I look at what happened, and so, you know, a few unique things here, I think, or a few transformative things. Every police chief, every police organization, you know, the National Fraternal Order of Police immediately condemned this for exactly what it is. Nobody tried to offer up an excuse to these officers. Nobody even tried to, as happened many times years ago, to kind of backpedal away from it by saying, well, I wasn't there. I really can't weigh in on that, right? The condemnation from the profession was swift and certain.
Hmm.
And also, I think when you look at prior years of protests, what is it that protesters have asked for over the years? And to me, they've really asked for four things. Right. The first one is change, obviously. And change takes time. Right. There's no switch that you flip. But I think progress is being made there. The other three things that they've consistently asked for are transparency, accountability, and justice.
Hmm.
And in this case, I think that Chief C.J. Davis down in Memphis, from the very beginning, was as transparent as she could be. She let people know what to expect. They got the body camera out, I guess, as quickly as they could, given the nature of the investigation. The officers were fired, very quickly and arrested and charged with murder. And they've also made it clear that the investigation isn't over, that additional officers and paramedics could also be facing some level of charges. So on that end, I think that the profession has responded to prior protests. We've heard the community. Mm-hmm. We've seen what they want and responded accordingly. And I think that that goes a long way as well.
Does this say that things are changing as a result of what we witnessed during COVID, George Floyd, and these other situations, that maybe we're learning as a society and as a law enforcement agency how to respond to these things better?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think that the years of trying to, in most places, at least I think that the years of, trying to sweep things under the rug, which never should have happened in the first place, are long behind us. And the ones who suffer for those bad cops are, first and foremost, the community that those officers serve. But secondly, is the other 750,000 police officers across the country. Who suffer for the actions of one or of, in this case, five, who, for months and years will be viewed with suspicion because of the actions of these five men.
We're talking to
many
former chief of the department, Ken Corey. Chief Corey, one of the things that keeps haunting me is you look at the video, why didn't someone stop them? How dysfunctional do people have to be that there isn't one sane person, one reasonable soul that's going to say, stop?
Yeah, so, this video is dramatically different. I mean, people like to draw comparisons to prior incidents of brutality and excessive force, and that's really unfair as well, right? Each incident stands on its own. But one of the things that struck me in this one, different from let's say George Floyd. In George Floyd, you have Chauvin, horrifically kneeling on George Floyd's neck, while other officers stand by and do nothing. This is completely different. You have five officers actively involved in this beating and murder. There is no one. None of them are there to intervene. I mean, I see two officers stand him up, hold his arm so that another officer can repeatedly punch him. I see him being held down so an officer can kick him, and kick him so hard that he apparently injures his own foot or leg in the process. Another one opening him up kind of as he's laying on the ground so that he can be struck with a baton. It would have taken another officer to come on the scene and do that intervention.
Tell us about the duty to intervene, because you talked about four things: change, transparency, accountability, and justice. And a change in policy, what is the duty to intervene?
So back in – the NYPD adopted the duty to intervene back in 2016 when we rewrote the use of force policy. And what that says is that – so prior to that, prior to 2016 in New York, when officers witnessed an officer use excessive force, they had an obligation to report that to Internal Affairs. And the failure to report that was in and of itself misconduct. In 2016, that then changed to not only do you have to report it, you have to stop it. You have to, if necessary, physically prevent that officer from using excessive force. Now, it wasn't until early 2021 that we began to teach officers how to do that. And that was through a program called ABLE, which stands for Active Bystandership for law enforcement, which was developed by Georgetown University's Law School Center for Innovations in Community Safety. Mm-hmm. And they require the department to agree to a certain certain conditions in order to adopt the program. But I was running training at the time. I saw it. I thought that it was critically important training to give the officers. It's one thing to tell them that they have to do it, and it's another thing to teach them how to do it, particularly when you're dealing with an officer who is more experienced, more senior, or higher ranking.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, how do you have that intervention? And the training aims to create a culture where the intervention is not only permitted, but it is actually encouraged. So we teach officers not only how to deliver an intervention, but also how to receive one. Mm. And many departments across the country have signed on to this program and continued this training. What strikes me as missing from that is from that video and that incident is supervision. As I watch that video in its entirety, I never see a supervisor on the scene, or certainly no one who appears to be a supervisor. No one ever takes control of that situation. Again, even after Mr. Nichols is handcuffed, no one comes on the scene to say, hey, what happened here? What do you got? When you're dealing with these specialized units, and again, lesson learned here from mistakes of the past, if you will, mm-hmm. when you're dealing with these specialized units that you send into high crime areas, as this Scorpion team was, and I have an issue just with that name, but you need very tight supervision. Mm. That span of control, what a supervisor is responsible for, a sergeant is responsible for, should be no more than four or five police officers. Wow. And that supervisor should be solely dedicated to their supervision. They shouldn't have any other supervisory duties yeah. that night.
Reverend, you and yes. I have asked the question several times, what about psychological evaluations? You train someone, you give someone the tools, but how far do you probe into the psychological makeup, and is it done periodically, Chief Corey?
So in New York, it's done pre-employment. There's a series of industry standard written tests, if you will, that officers take, and those measure different characteristics, and one of them is aggression, right? So to see how they score on that, and then they get interviewed by they do a face-to-face assessment with a psychologist. They are not done periodically. They are done if the supervisor refers somebody out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of that would be that would require negotiations with labor unions. It would require, you know, significantly more staffing of psychologists. That's not to say that it can't be done or shouldn't be done. It's just not done now.
Mm-hmm. And the concern of a stigma that would be associated with ongoing psychological review, correct?
Well, I think that you remove stigma. So, there's a big focus now on wellness, which is critically important and was missing, you know, for years. So, you know, we've become much more in tune with the vicarious trauma that young people experience, that members of the community experience, and how that impacts them. But police officers obviously suffer vicarious trauma, too, and in many ways, you know, much more frequently than community members do. And so that undoubtedly impacts them. And one of the ways, I think, in the wellness aspect that we remove the stigma is we require officers who are involved in a traumatic incident to see a psychologist. And everybody has to go. So you go in the room privately, and I know this from speaking to the psychologist, you can go in the room privately. You spend an hour with the psychologist, you can come out with your chest all puffed up and talk about what nonsense it was. But we know that 50% of the time, those officers are asking for more help behind closed doors. Mm. And that's progress. That's certainly a step in the right direction.
Chief, you mentioned the understaffing and the morale. So how do we, first of all, what's the reason for it? The exodus? We read about the exodus of a number of seasoned officers who say they've had enough. Why is it we can't get more people who we should be getting to come forward?
You know, I think that there's a few reasons for that, and it's not complicated. I mean, one is the public narrative around policing right now, and particularly in communities of color. This is a conversation that I had with community leaders for many years. I said, you know, it's extremely challenging when you vilify police with every word out of your mouth to then convince someone in that community that they should join the police department and, you know, help diversify the police and serve their community. It's also, so the public dialogue around it, but pay has not kept pace with inflation in many police departments. Mm. And New York probably chief among them. So, you know, NYPD PBA has been without a contract since 2017. They got their last raise in 2016. Wow. Chief of officers working 6.5 years without getting a raise. Mm-hmm. You know, starting salary is tens of thousands below what it should be. Mm. You know, when I started in 1988, my starting salary was $26,000. Today, officers start at $42,000. But that $26,000 adjusted for inflation today should be $65,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
We're going to have to take a break right here. So can we ask you to hold on, Chief Corey?
Absolutely.
Rev, you can stay with us?
Can I stay with you?
You better.
It right. Will be the Rev and the Rabbi.
Exactly.
We'll be back.
There's no rabbi without a Rev, no Rev without a rabbi. All right.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
And we have on the line with us someone who has a stellar reputation in policing, and I'm talking about former chief of the Department of NYPD, Ken Corey. And one of the things I'm saying to myself as I listen to Chief Corey and Rev, I'm sure you're saying the same, don't allow this video to formulate your entire opinion of a police department. Hmm. There are many, many dedicated, decent officers who are ready to sacrifice their lives each and every day. Don't judge them by the brutality of these five. We all have in our respective enclaves people who shame us, people who diminish who we are, but we cannot allow them to define us. Let's go back to Chief Corey. Chief, you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
How do we get young people to consider becoming members of the police department, given all that you said?
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's still a lot of people who want to join the police department. What New York doesn't face necessarily the same recruiting challenges that other departments do, believe it or not. I mean, there are still more than 10,000 people, you know, on the list waiting to be called and processed, you know, to potentially get a seat in the academy. Some of the challenges just surround being able to do that as quickly to keep pace with the number of officers that left, right, hamstrung for a number of reasons, you know, classes delayed because of the pandemic and so on. What bothers me most in New York, or what worries me most, is not retirements, because those are fairly predictable. Officers are going to work 20, 25 years. Some, you know, gluttons for punishment like myself will do 34 and a half, and then eventually pack it in. It's the young officers who are leaving for other departments, right? So our police officers, listen, New York City police officers are widely regarded as the best in the business. They're not perfect. There's always room for improvement. But I know as I travel around the country to other departments that they are the gold standard. Other departments recognize that, too, and they are aggressively recruiting them away, not just regionally, not just out to Nassau and Suffolk counties, or over to the Port Authority, but they're being taken down to departments in Florida, Texas, the Carolinas, and Tennessee. You know, where the lure is, not only are they making more money than they're making in New York City, it's obviously a much lower cost of living and a different quality of life. So the city is going to have to address that inequity at some point if they want to be able to keep the best and brightest here.
Chief and Rabbi, you know, I have to address an elephant in the room on this one, because we have watched these kind of things, and it's been white police officers. Then with George Floyd, it was, and other incidents, it was a mixture of white and black. But now, these were five black officers, and in the community of color, and I've spoken to clergy across the country, and community leaders, you know. Three things: anger, confusion, and tears. Anger about the abuse of power, you know, that continues from people that we put in positions of trust, but confusion because it was perpetrated by black officers. We teach our children, in our community especially, to respect authority. And what do we say to them when they see and experience authority acting like street thugs? Because that's what that video showed. So it's extra painful on the family and embarrassing for a community of color. And I would think that those officers of color who see this feel that kind of pain and feel that kind of embarrassment. Would you say that that is a sentiment within the department?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, all police officers are disgusted by this, but officers of color, I think even more so. You know, a number of them come to the department, and they come from it. And listen, we have officers who represent all walks of life, you know, spent their life in, you know, in public housing and grew up. And this was their ticket to the middle class, if you will, right? A civil service job and a steady paycheck. But at the same time, they wanted to make change, and they felt that the best way to make change was from within. And that's why they came to policing. They want to serve their community, and one of the ways they want to do that is by making the NYPD better or making their local police department better. And now they feel doubly betrayed, right? You know, betrayed by their profession and betrayed by people who had a lot in common with them and they felt should have been working to make change instead of perpetuating systemic violence.
Yeah. And that's the idea, because we fought to have officers of color on the force, because at one time, you know, discrimination was there, very present. And the hopes was that having individuals who are sensitive to our various communities, whether it's Asian or Latino or African-American, that it would make a difference. It would help, you know, like you say, change the culture. So it's disheartening to witness this kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and I think that there is no, you know, there is no magic wand, and people who are predisposed, you know, to this type of behavior exist in all races, in all creeds. And that's where the screening process comes in. You know, I think another thing that struck me looking at the video, you know, really more the aftermath of the video and after the beating stops and they're all kind of milling around very casually is, There is no, you know, oh boy, you know, what did we do moment, if you will.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which to me would tend to signal that they've done this before.
Wow.
Right? You know, so I'd be curious to see as the investigation continues what comes out about, you know, their own history of complaints and, you know, and possibly prior interactions that may have been overlooked. You know, Memphis, you know, very violent city. You know, right near the top of in terms of murders per capita, I think they had 325 homicides last year. New York had about 425. Memphis is a city of 628,000.
Wow.
You know, that would translate into over 5,000 murders in New York City, just to kind of put that in perspective. So we put the pressure on the police to drive that down. And the police are not the solution to every problem, or certainly not the sole solution to the problem. And when you do that and they form these specialized units, police administrators then have a tendency, unfortunately, to kind of turn a blind eye to things because, well, they're getting the job done. And we saw that in Baltimore with the Gun Trace Task Force and all the brutality that they were involved in that, you know, it turns out that higher-ups knew about. But, well, you know, they were bringing in guns and drugs, so, you know, we're just going to kind of let them go. And again, certainly the wrong approach.
Chief Ken Corey. We've come to the end of the segment. I think the lesson also is here: don't let the few define the many. There are many decent. The decent outweigh the indecent. And
I'll certainly say amen to that, Rabbi.
Well, you're an exemplar of the. By the way, Ken, you go to Zavarian?
I did. Yeah,
I was on the board. Yeah. Oh, okay. I gotta get your transcript. To take a look at it.
don't look too closely at the number of times I was in defense.
I'm sure your parents were proud. Chief of Department of NYPD, Ken Corey, thank you so much. Look forward to having more conversations with you.
Great input on the program. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Reverend Rabbi. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right. God bless. And we'll be back with more of the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. I really enjoyed that, Rabbi.
Well, Ken Corey has an exemplary reputation. You can see that by listening to him and the years of experience. But, you know, what keeps coming back to me is, Rev, I understand there was understaffing. I understand we didn't attract the best, but this never should have happened.
You know,
even if you have mediocre, this shouldn't have happened. The brutality is unjustifiable.
But we ran out of time. You know, I wish we could have spent a little bit more time because in the beginning he said specifically that he did not like the name of that team, the Scorpion team. Because when we start to give these kind of identities and create a role and function, that's aggressive. That's designed to be, you know, the SWAT team that comes in and takes no prisoners. I think that develops a mindset amongst officers who are part of these teams. He talked about Baltimore. You know, we had the street crimes unit here in New York, which was a problem. And it tends to lead to over-policing. I wish we could have spent a little bit more time on that idea of creating these teams and creating a persona and looking the other way because they're getting the job done.
You know, let me get biblical for a moment. You look back at the story of Cain and Abel, and Cain kills Abel. And one of the defenses Cain offers, according to the commentaries, is, well, there's no law against killing your brother. The commandments hadn't been operative at that point. Mm-hmm. And the commentator says, you don't need a law to tell you not to kill your brother. And the same thing here. You don't need a rule to tell you not to brutalize someone this way.
Yeah.
This is just unconscionable. And you would think that someone would come forward and say, stop. But it didn't happen. And by the way, this young man had thoughts of becoming a member of the police department.
Yeah.
He wanted to affect change.
And to think about the cameras, because if it wasn't for that pole camera, because the body cam gave us some audio, but the pole camera had an angle that was indefensible.
I guess it's a message for all of us that when we see something that shouldn't be happening, when we hear something that shouldn't be said, we are duty-bound to say something.
We've got to say something. And what I mean by in angle indefensible, I'm talking about the angle that which it recorded the video and showed what happened. And that video is indefensible. They're going to try to defend it in court, I'm sure. You know, I was listening to one of the defense attorneys for Miller, one of the police officers, but he's going to have a hard time with this. Yeah. You know, I'm sure he's going to do the best he can. That's his job. But it's tough when you have footage like this. And the police chief said that she felt it's worse than Rodney King. And this is before we saw it. And one thing, Rabbi, you and I know, which is important, the fact that police departments across the country reached out to community leaders and clergy mm-hmm. before the video was shown in order to bring everyone in on this. And I think this kind of communication is important. What do you think, Rabbi?
100%. I think it only reinforces our responsibility to address issues forthrightly. You know, someone say, well, you stick to religion. This is part of religion.
Yeah.
You know, the prophetic voice, confrontation with the issues of the day, speaking, to the powers that may be in front of you. You can't be timid because you pay a price. When you close your eyes, you don't see or hear the tears.
I love what you just said. It's religion. It's our responsibility. We bring a moral value consensus, which is necessary for justice and concord. It's important. Excellent, Rabbi. Great segment.
We're going to go now to the conference line and speak to someone you and I have come to know and respect over the years.
Another guest.
Yeah, he is the Deputy Consul General of the State of Israel, Israel Nitzan. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us this morning. I was sitting at the United Nations for the commemoration of Holocaust Remembrance, International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The same day, there was a sadistic attack on worshipers in a synagogue in Jerusalem. And I thought to myself, this attack is shameful any day. But here we are remembering people who died because they were Jews. And we're hearing again of people who died because they were Jews. What do you have to say, Councilor John?
Yeah, it's we actually had a very difficult weekend, a very difficult Shabbat in Jerusalem with two attacks, two shooting attacks, terrorist shooting attacks. The one was Friday night. On Friday night, a Palestinian terrorist opened deadly, and I should say indiscriminate, fire towards innocent civilians as they were leaving their Jerusalem synagogue after the Shabbat service. We by now have seven civilians who were murdered, among them a 14-year-old boy and some elderly people. So, and of course, the timing, and especially having such an attack during the International Holocaust Memorial Day is something that is extremely painful. On Saturday morning, also during Shabbat, a 13-year-old, I say terrorist, Palestinian, shot with a gun at civilians. Two were injured, one severely, on the way to the prayer in Jerusalem. So again, the same situation. I want to say maybe two more things. One, first of all, that you know, not many people mention the fact that we're talking about a 13-year-old who actually launched this attack, this terrorist attack against civilians. Mm. Now, terrorist organizations in the Palestinian territories are actually in Gaza, but also in Jenin and in Nablus, are encouraging and inciting for children to be involved in terrorist attacks against innocent civilians in Israel. And they are using fake news nonstop, also online, using different social media platforms to incite and to call on the murders of innocent Israelis. And this has to stop. The second thing that I want to say here as an Israeli diplomat in New York, that since Friday night, we've received many messages of condolences from elected and community leaders, including nationally, of course, President Biden called Prime Minister Netanyahu and Vice President Harris called President Herzog, but also here in New York, we greatly value the support and the friendship with the expressions of condolences and solidarity by Governor Hochul, by Mayor Adams, as well as many members of Congress. And of course, we're grateful for these expressions of support.
I have to just bring this up because there are those, and look, the killing of innocent people is a problem across the boards. I have a special love for the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. They're part of my religious history. But there are those who say that this attack comes, you know, directly after a deadly Israeli raid in a refugee camp. And nine Palestinians were killed. How do you respond to that association?
We need to put things in an accurate context. This the IDF is operating in specifically in Jenin, in a refugee camp in Jenin, has been operating over there for several months, almost a year now. This place is under the full control of the Palestinian Authority. We have centers of terrorism. Nests of terrorism within these camps, and they launch and they guide different terrorists in their planning and attacks against Israel. The IDF has no other option but to operate over there because the Palestinian Authority does not do anything to stop them. Actually, on the contrary, they do not do anything, and they actually pay salaries to the terrorists who were arrested and in Israel. So we the IDF is operating based on specific intelligence in order to stop ticking bombs. This is a legitimate self-defensive measure in Jenin, and targeting, and again, an imminent threat from led by the Islamic Jihad terrorist organization over there. You cannot compare between a raid in order to prevent a terrorist attack in Israel and an attack that is inexcusable against against civilians in a synagogue, against worshippers in any house of worship. So I think that such an equation, and we hear it in different places on social media, I think that it's morally wrong.
You know, I wanted you to respond to it because, you know, there are people who accuse this Israeli government of hypocrisy and a double standard, but you made it clear that this is a false equivalence.
Well, we speak of that moral equivalence some people try to make, where a person perpetrates a heinous act and the person responding to it is held as guilty, right, condemned for responding to the person who attacks him. I mean, what are you supposed, from a religious standpoint, you have a responsibility to prevent, you know, your demise. You know, we have a statement in Jewish law that if someone's coming to kill you, you better deal with him, you know, strongly and make sure he doesn't kill you. But you can't be held to the same, you know, position as the one who's committing the ugly act. And we see it all the time. I remember Deputy Consul General, when it came to Operation Protective Edge, he had Gaza launching missiles one after the other. And then when Israel responded, all of a sudden I saw all these articles, these comments condemning Israel for responding, you know, to the Gaza attack. It's just...
I totally agree with you, Robert. And I think that, again, we should not... There are people who say certain things on social media. They create a certain discourse on social media and elsewhere. I don't think that you can equate between the two. And again, it has been going on for several months, almost a year now, of activity, IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces activity especially in the Jenin refugee camp, because this is where they are. Believe me, had we had the support of the Palestinian Authority, which this refugee camp is under their full control, they should be under full control. They choose not to go there. They choose not to prevent these terror activities from a camp that is under their full control. Israel has no other no other choice but to operate, and this is what we've been seeing in the last several months.
There is a difference between the arsonist and the one who puts out the fire. You know, I see people, the one who puts out the fire and there's a loss of life is held to the same, you know, responsibility as the arsonist, and that's just outrageous.
So it's really to the benefit of the Palestinian authorities to allow this to take place because it continues their agenda against the state of Israel, correct?
Unfortunately, I agree with you that it's not a matter of their decision not to operate against these terrorists in the Jenin refugee camp. They actually, again, they pay salaries to terrorists who were apprehended and arrested and sit in Israeli prisons, the pay-for-slay infamous policy. When they pay terrorists salaries, they pay their families salaries because they sit in Israeli prisons today. This has to stop. And I think that this is also the position of the American government as well.
It's more than just looking the other way. It's being complicit with these actions.
So what I don't understand is, I always thought, correct me if I'm wrong, that people want to live in peace. We pray for peace. We're told to pursue peace. And yet we're hearing about those who subsidize terrorists. And it seems that there are those who don't want to live in peace. And I just don't understand that. You want your kids to have a better life than you've had. We all feel that way. Why would anybody get into this sick kind of behavior of supporting terrorist actions, Consul General?
I agree with you that this is what you would expect, what I would expect from people who, from a, and especially a government that's talking about the Palestinian Authority, who is actually would like to leave peacefully with their Jewish and Israeli neighbors. This is not the case, and they insist on doing that. I think that's, I think the conclusion is clear that if you encourage, you basically encourage terrorism by making sure that terrorists who leave their home, go out to, like this 13-year-old boy yesterday. He took a gun. He went out to the street in order to attack and to commit a terror attack against Israeli civilians. He knows that his family is going to leave to enjoy also the benefit, the financial benefit of what he has done due to the policy of the Palestinian Authority. And I agree with you that this is the wrong message, and let's say it's first of all it's morally wrong, but this is not. It clearly indicates that as long as this policy is ongoing, we won't be able to reach peace in the Holy Land.
I think it's important also, Consul General, that people understand that this is more than just the right of the Palestinian state to exist. It's the belief that the state of Israel should not exist. It would be one thing to say, okay, we need to exist too, but it's another thing to say we need to exist and the state of Israel should not be in existence. Correct?
I agree with you, but I add one more argument here. Nothing can justify terrorism. Nothing. And as long as you justify terrorism, as long as you allow terrorist activities by, again, not preventing it or by encouraging terrorists financially, you encourage terrorism. And it is wrong. Nothing can justify it. It is wrong legally. It is the wrong thing to do for your people. It's a failure of their leadership, the Palestinian leadership, who encourage it. And I'm afraid that, you know, we were talking about peace in the region and peace in the Holy Land. And at the end of the day, Israel has now today relationships with many members of the region. In the region, we just had last month another meeting of the Negev Forum, in which the U.S., Israel, and four Arab countries, the UAE, the Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt, and Morocco, had discussions on how we can actually promote a better situation in the region, promote peace, and to promote the well-being of our peoples. When you have the opposite message coming from the Palestinian Authority, I wish things would have been different.
Yeah.
But this is it. You have a camp in the region who speaks about peace, who speaks about the well-being of the people, actually prioritizes the well-being of the people, while you have a Palestinian Authority encouraging terrorism, financing terrorism indirectly, and I think that they should choose the right path in history.
Yeah, we're never going to see peace, the reality of peace, as long as people travel on that path of destruction, of seeking to completely erase another people from the world. It is just sick. And just, it's immoral. It contravenes every religion, at least on paper. How people choose to live is something else. Rev, before we let the Consul General go, Deputy Consul General Nitzan go, I want to say something that you reinforced before. You know, I was present. You were honored by the State of Israel, Reverend Bernard. You have been a great friend. You just said before, it's in your DNA. It's in your, you know, religious resume, so to speak. I think people today have every right to criticize Israel if they so choose. But I'd like them to begin, as you said earlier, with a declarative statement. I love Israel. Now, after you say that, then let me hear all the other stuff. But there are those who just condemn, criticize, and they don't speak with any love or respect for the state. That, to me, is unacceptable. Because 75 years, look at what Israel has done. 75 years, you know, after a Holocaust, we have a state of Israel. I mean, it's a young country. It's made mistakes, but it's also corrected mistakes. And it seems a model for democracy with all of its flaws, as America is, but we're a little bit older. I just think there has to be the recognition of a real special country, which many of us simply love.
Yeah. And with this whole issue of peace, you know, there's a wonderful passage in the Hebrew scriptures, rabbis, in the Psalms, Psalm 55. And it says, the words of his mouth were smoother than butter, mm-hmm. but war was in his heart.
Yeah.
You can't make peace with a person who has war in their heart.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Remember years ago, Golda Meir said, you know, somebody said, you got to negotiate with the terrorists. And she said, well, what should I negotiate? What time you want to destroy me? Should we negotiate for the hour?
You can't do it. You
Deputy Consul General Israel Nitzan, a great friend of ours, a great representative of the State of Israel. We are very, very fortunate to have you with us.
Yes, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
God bless. Shalom.
All right.
We'll be back.
Yeah, well, right? but when we come back, Rev, because I want to leave on back. I want to leave on an uplifting note. You gave a stirring message to members of the Senate. So why don't we hear about that? No, we got to conclude a positive note. That's a religious response in general, that you always have to leave with a sense of optimism for the future. We'll be back.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Pachasnik, the Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Pachasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
All right, let's go on a positive note. The Senate, the message you gave.
I had an opportunity this past week to pray for the opening of the Senate, and, you know, I felt a prophetic opportunity and a prophetic responsibility to challenge our government. You know, too often we get up and we offer, you know, eloquent, beautiful words of about God. But this was about challenging our leaders, you know, to bring the kingdom of God, the authority of God, the power of God, the presence of God, to change hearts, minds, and lives of the people by truth, righteousness, justice, and peace, and transform our nation, you know, its political constructs, our social institutions, all of that. So it went viral, by the way. But, you know, I think in those opportunities, we have a responsibility to be prophetic, to be a prophetic voice. You know, government is there to restrain evil, preserve order, promote justice and the common good. And we need to hold them accountable with our voice.
So I'm going to watch the behavior of the Senate following that prayer. And if there's no change, Rev,
I think there's going
to
be a need for a follow-up prayer.
You know what? They need to hear that. They need to know that people are watching and people are speaking.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. And they have to be held accountable, as you said. Rev, thank you so much. This has
been a great program, Rabbi. You know, great to be with you this morning.
You know, I came in today, I was feeling somewhat dejected, and I walk away feeling uplifted. As I said, one day you see the ugliness in America, but don't forget the beauty in America. And I think this morning we experienced some of that beauty.
Hey, God bless America, man. It's a great place to be, to live and to just experience life.
And let's thank always WABC. I'm sitting here in the Bernard McGurk studio, and he was a great contributor to the station, and he's being remembered. And all of us have a responsibility when we sit behind microphones to speak out and
absolutely
not be afraid.
Be responsible and prophetic, right? Yeah. So, and thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the program today, and tune in next week for another injection of the Rev and the Rabbi.
God bless.